talking about everyone having needs from doing checkbooks and now having little tools that they can control the lights in their house right from a computer. You know, open the garage doors right from a central computer. And these things are actually becoming kind of common today. Back then, though, it was science fiction talk. It was like the TV shows. It was, you know, we are creating the future. And what really helped as much as anything, big companies started saying, no, it was a little small thing. Analysts were saying it wasn't going to go anywhere at first, and it was going to be small business and only apply to a few. And we somehow had a feeling in us that we were on this big revolution. We were going to build devices where people could type messages to bulletin boards and 100 other people could read them, and it was going to be like a communication tool as well as other things. We didn't foresee the internet, you know, and what it's brought us, but still, we did see, we saw this tool was just going to be so amazing. And I think the thought that really drove me the most, because I thought, oh my God, I have technical skills. I know how to build things. I want to be a part of this great, great thing that's going to change the world. I want to contribute anything I can. Our club was based on everybody was sharing. If you have something to offer, offer it. If you have something you need, speak up, you know, and somebody will link up with you. And we're all helping each other, and we're sharing schematics. We're sharing code listings of programs. And, you know, basically, we're bringing this to the world because we're good do-gooders. And I felt so honored to be a part of that. Take my technical prowess and be able to design these machines of the future, you know, and impress people, too.
Yeah, I was speaking to a couple of young, like 19-year-old programmers yesterday, and they were saying, you know, as much as they love coding, programming and stuff, you know, kind of core to the whole kind of the kind of cult of coding, if you like, is impressing your mates with cool stuff. How important was that?
To me, it was very important. I was very shy, and a lot of nerds are shy because they're social outsiders in the normal world. They haven't learned all the ways of nice small talk, and they just want to answer questions directly, and they've just been outsiders, sort of. Well, one of the ways to communicate is if you ever do something that impresses your other technical friends, they'll come up to you and, wow, that is cool, how'd you do that? And you all of a sudden you have a voice in the world, and I was very much like that, and I'd love to try to come up with a clever approach than the last guy had. You know, maybe a program that took somebody else 10 steps for a little tiny function, I would try to figure out a way to do it in even 3 steps. Just search the manual, search every idea I could come up with, go, you know, work for weeks and come up with a little brilliant thing. Maybe it only brought it down to 9 steps instead of 10. But somebody looking at it would also have to say, yes, it goes in the most logical order, the way a mind should go. It is superb, it is supreme. That is what we all sought, was the absolute perfection in programs. I was more a hardware designer. My programs were very much like my hardware design, and that was connecting little chips that put out ones and zeros in the right order, so at the very end of the chain, the right ones and zeros came out.
Do you see any parallels with, like, say, the modern open source movement as to the kind of the collaborative spirit that you had back in the early 70s?
Yes, I think that this open source movement and the thinking that it embodies, which is share what we have, create something, you can still benefit from the value of it, but let other people see what you've done, learn from it, be able to extend it, and come up with better ideas and better it. And most companies just want to shut things off. Nope, we own it, it's so proprietary, we don't want anybody out there mucking with it, and doing something more than we thought of, doing something better than we thought of, doing something special just for themselves that we want total control. Well, I don't believe in that. I mean, basically, the element is let the people who are talented have the ability to add things in and do it a little bit their way, you know, otherwise you shut down the innovation. So I'm very, very favorable of the open source movement. The Apple II itself, everything about it was just exploded and printed and given away, the designs, the code, and people came out and they designed products and they got in and they added little hooks and little ways to change what we had to make it work better or work differently in other situations.
So all you guys were kind of all working together in a very open source way. So what was your response when Bill Gates sent you his, you know, open letter to the hobbyists?
Well, Bill Gates came out with BASIC, and one of the things to having a complete final computer that can really do a job for you, whatever form it's in, whether it's a big front panel computer or a little Apple with a typewriter keyboard, you've got to run a programming language. You've got to be able to sit down and write programs. Because what really inspired me was this talk that the guy who was smart and knew how to write a program was going to be more important than the CEO in the company. He was going to, like, be the heart of the company. We were going to be the little guys that were, you know, slave Goliath. And so I forget what the question was.
Just your response, you know, Bill Gates wrote that letter.
Bill Gates had a BASIC, and this BASIC was important. to being in control, being able to quickly go into work. I could go into Hewlett-Packard, write programs in BASIC. I wrote my own BASIC after Bill Gates because he kind of, his name was getting around. And I love to have my name get around, so I wrote my own BASIC as quick as I could. And I could solve my simulation problems at Hewlett-Packard. The ones I used to use a large computer for, I could do myself now. And Bill Gates finally wrote a letter to our club because he heard we were buying his BASIC and then duplicating it. Or I don't even know if we bought it or got it free, but somebody borrowed, Dan Sokol took the tape home and brought like five copies back and joked that if you ever take something from the club library, you bring back more copies than you started with. And Bill Gates wrote a letter, you know, opposing that kind of piracy. And, you know, I think most responsible engineers and software people would say, yeah, you can't copy my stuff and rip me off without permission.
But do you think that kind of defined a bit of an ideological battle, that, you know, that Silicon Valley and Microsoft?
I never felt that it defined an ideological battle. I think it was in our club, it was just a joke. There were so few people who had that much of a computer and a hugely expensive teletype to type on or something, and all the cards to hook it up to actually take advantage of getting Bill Gates' BASIC for free, that it was kind of a joke. Yeah, that we made. It wasn't. But, you know, his letter had obvious meaning. You know, I design it. You know, you can't just steal it from me. Pay me for it.
So I
sort of went the opposite way. With my Apple I, I just passed out the schematics to everyone. No copyright notices. Here, take it. You can build your own. So, but by the Apple II, we were treated differently. No, we thought the Apple II was a real big device, that this market was going to go somewhere now. And we did not treat it as openly. In the hardware, the design of the machine, it was open. Tons of places for other companies to come in and develop their products and expand the whole personal computer marketplace. A lot of room for that, but not to just copy our chips wholesale. We gave them other ways to do their own stuff.
So you're tinkering around kind of, you know, with the Altair and so on, and the Homebrew Club. How did this then translate? I mean, tell me how you kind of hooked up with Steve Jobs and translated this into a business idea.
Okay. Well, 5 years before that, I had built a little Altair computer of my own design. An executive at a company got me some chips and built this thing, and it had the switches and the lights, and you could push buttons and get ones and zeros into memory and do that stuff. So I'd already been there. You don't want to go backwards. And now here's all these other people hung up on Altairs, which are like the most incredible thing ever in my life. A little computer framework and all the switches and lights and the buttons and what they do and the programs they can run. But I'd already been to the one step. When I was at that, designing that first computer, I'd been introduced to Steve Jobs. And he was interested in technology, but he was also very interested. He was less an engineer and a designer who could take a lot of pieces and design things that didn't yet exist. He could understand a schematic and look at the voltages on an oscilloscope and do that. So he was a lower level than a designer, but he had to make up for it. He had this far thinking about what kind of far end products were going to change the world. And he wanted to be one of the great, you know, people that you always refer to as one of the ones that changed the world, that was the leader of mankind, that took us to the newer, greater places. So he was always asking me questions. He was saying, could this machine ever run a programming language? Could this machine ever have a disk? Could this machine ever have more than one user using it at the same time, so you could sell a service? And he was always looking for ways you could sell something that had value in that sense.
So the dynamic between you was?
Oh, well, we had a lot of other things in common. We loved to joke about pranks. We loved to pull pranks together. We were both a little bit irreverent in that sense, both into a lot of the modern counterculture type thoughts of the day, and, you know, kind of freedom of expression and all the things that go along with that. Steve was more of a true, what I'd call a hippie, who kind of lived more of the hippie life of kind of have nothing and whatever you think of doing is okay to do. And I was more centered. I was good. You know, even though I could pay attention to a lot of good thoughts, I didn't want to sway my life into a life of drugs or not having money. You know, but aside from that, we were just best friends for 7 years. You know, we started a company together to have the two of us have our own company.
So, yeah, you mentioned the counterculture. How did the counterculture affect your thinking of what this company was going to do?
I think the counterculture just affected my thinking in just a lot of other ways of trying to look for truth. Going back to Vietnam War days and growing up in high school and watching a lot of people, get involved in the drugs of the late 60s. And, directly, some people that came from that counterculture type Let your mind go outside and freely think, and don't just say there's a set of rules and this is the set of rules I follow to live by. They applied that sort of thinking to technology and saying we can build devices that will do this and that, and they really came up with a lot more of the innovative, inventive thoughts that nobody else was thinking of at the time, especially the big companies. And I think it was just essential. If they hadn't been exploding, you know, well, the world, not the world, but our little hobby magazines were getting spread around the country, and they were just putting out this message of computers could do everything for anyone, and computers were really going to help us, you know, organize and help the little guy be bigger than the big guy. That was the biggest counterculture message, that the little guy, you know, could be even smarter and have a better place and be ahead of the big established businessman. So, and I think that talk was just so inspiring. You just want to be a part of it if you can. That's how I felt.
But, you know, the hobbyist kind of movement and the Alta and stuff like that, it was still very much, you know, you still had to be very a technical engineer type person to use it. I mean, how is your company going to be different?
Well, that really all came from me. Because Steve Jobs wasn't even going to the computer club at first. And I finally realized that, oh my gosh, I'm going to have my own computer. The only way I could afford anything was if I built it myself. I could get the chips from Hewlett Packard. I could design it on paper with a pencil. I had a television set for my output that was free because I already owned my television. And I had to buy a keyboard, and that was very expensive in those days. Very expensive, but I bought one keyboard. And now I could type on a keyboard and watch it on my TV set. And that was a big break from the Altair line of thinking. One of the reasons I did it was you don't want to do the same thing twice. Like I said, I had already built a machine equivalent to the Altair in my life. So you don't want to go back and do that a second time. You want to do something better. And of course, I could think of ways to do it better with fewer chips than before. But I looked at our Hewlett-Packard calculators where I worked. We had a small, and I had never thought that we had a computer inside. And I realized, well, we really have this processor. It's really like a computer. And the way it works is it reads a normal keyboard that human beings can understand. Normal people can push 45, 63, and say, Adam. And the buttons are real clear to a human. I said, that's really an idea. And what it depends on is when you turn the calculator on, it runs a program that watches what you type. So I said, why don't I just write a little program? Took two chips, put a tiny little program in that watches what you type on a human keyboard and lets you type that way. And the reason I did it was to save all the money. See, I always like to make things smaller, 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 but it only made sense if in the end it saved money or looked extremely simple. I got rid of this big, huge pieces of metal holding a big computer. I got rid of tons of drilling holes and putting switches in and screwing them on and hooking up wires and running those wires to chips that somehow knew how to get them in the ones and zeros into memory. I got rid of all that by just writing a simple little program. And it was just a real, real lucky thing. It wasn't that I said, well, what do you really have to do to solve the problems of humanity? I wasn't that far thinking. I was just in the right place at the right time. I just knew how to do it and wanted to go forward and wanted things as cheap as possible. I did anything in the world to always get things to cost less. And this was the formula that cost less. Another big formula was all the hobby computers like the Altair were using static memories, 2104s or whatever they were called. And it turns out that you had to have four times as many of those chips as the dynamic memories that came out. The 4K dynamic memory came out in 1975, and it was the first memory ever on silicon, this is Silicon Valley, that was going to be cheaper than the magnetic core memories they'd always used in all the IBM computers and all the mini computers of all time. So I designed for the dynamic memories because I could use 8 chips instead of 32 chips to have enough memory to run a computer program. That was really my only intent, was to save money and save parts. I always look, whatever it takes, you figure out how to design it. A little harder to design, but that's what you do when your real goal is not how easy is it to do, it's how simple can you make it.
So while you were busy doing all this, what was the other Steve's
role?
Yeah.
Okay, well, after I told you I was passing out the schematics for free to everybody at the club, because I wanted to tell people, hey, you can have your own computer, build your own like I did. And Steve came by and he said, wow, there's a lot of people interested. Why don't we make a PC board for $20 and sell it for $40? He had come from working at surplus electronics stores where when companies had a ton of thousands of switches left over, they'd sell them for just pennies on the dollar. And then these surplus stores would sell them to hobbyists like we all were. You'd go in, you'd find the switches you wanted, and you'd buy them for a huge markup over what the surplus company had paid for them. Steve was used to that. So his idea was not to start a computer company at first, but to start a company that made a piece of the computer that I was already giving away. And almost right away, he got an order from the one computer store for 100 computers at $500 each. That's $50,000. That was twice my annual salary. So that was quite a shock. And one of the hoops I had to go through was I worked for Hewlett-Packard. They owned what I designed in my mind. So I tried to persuade them to build this product. And in the end, I had 5 turndowns from Hewlett-Packard. Yeah, sort of disappointing, but they would have done it wrong, I think. You know, I would have lost control. When I was designing every bit of the computer myself, all the hardware, all the software, I had total control. That was probably the only time in my life that nobody else is telling me. Well, I actually did a lot of side projects where I had that kind of total control. That was just my way. But if Hewlett-Packard did it, they partitioned a lot of different people, combining different talents, it'd be the wrong product. Would have been.
So it was quite a jump for you to sort of go right
through there.
And yeah, I wanted a computer to be, you know, not so much to be just this whole, whoa, it's like a typewriter, you type on it and see on a screen. I wanted that for low cost, not because I saw that was really what people were gonna like as far as a better user environment. But it was more the way to be fun. Everything in my mind was, how do I get to a computer that I can run games on to impress people, as well as my work at Hewlett-Packard? And that fancifulness, and that's really what led to putting in a lot of things that people never thought were gonna come to a basic low-cost computer, like the color, like the graphics to have animated games, like the high resolution, which is like pixels, where you can get things close to photo resolution. Those sort of things were just lucky ideas. They fell out of the chips that I designed with for free.
So is it true that...
Sorry? Steve?
I know, my phone buzzed.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I know. Well, somebody sent me a URL for a gold Razer, and I thought, wow, I'll get a gold Razer. And came in and I told somebody, wow, I got this thing, it's Dolce Gabbana or something. They said, oh, Dolce Gabbana. It's a name, it's a designer name. I didn't know. I would never buy a designer name, but I love it now that I got it. And going back to the Homebrew Computer Club, a lot of people were bringing in projects, kits that they had bought and built, and they would set up little demos, you know, programs that they'd been able to punch the ones and zeros into memory. So, and that was just kind of exciting to be one of those people doing demos. And I was trying to say, here is a whole newer, different way. And my big claim to fame was I had this one little board with so few chips on it, everybody looks at it and it's like a small little board and it's running a whole computer language. It was like, try to be that impressive. And then act like it's normal and just pass out the schematics.
Is this your first time being interviewed in the forest?
Probably is, although I can't say for sure I wasn't ever interviewed at my old house.
So, you know, you built the Apple One. How much of a leap was it then to actually leave your job and go into business for real?
Well, the Apple One was, I thought it was not really a turning point. It was not a computer design. I took a video terminal I had actually already designed so that I could talk to computers on the early internet called the ARPANET, and then I modified it to have the computer sitting on the same board. So it was like a hack together, build it up design. And the Apple II was really a computer, designed to be a computer from ground up, designed to be a color computer from ground up. And that was the one that, here's what happened. At first, it looked like little hobby computers were just selling in the tens and hundreds from a whole bunch of little companies that were starting up with two people like me and Steve Jobs. And we were just in that group. And after the Apple I, Processor Technology, company up in Emeryville near Berkeley, I think that's where they were, their members came to our Homebrew Computer Club. They came out with a computer called the Processor Technology SOL, S-O-L, based on the same Intel chips as the Altair and most of the other hobby computers. And it had a video screen and a keyboard. And you sat there, and it had a little bit of software running. So it was that paradigm extended to another level. And all of a sudden, this was the computer that was blowing away the world. Of all these little hobby computers, this was the one that was selling 1,000 a month. And Steve came to me and said, look, it's selling 1,000 a month. The Apple II is 10 times better. We can sell 1,000 a month. Easy, for sure. You know, if we put this out, and we needed money. We needed to raise money to do that because we had zero. I mean, Steve and I were in our young 20s, no business experience, you know, and just sort of gambling around, just trying to make little decisions on our own. You know, hey, here's how we'll do this. For the Apple I, we got the parts on 30 days credit, built the computers, and got paid cash in 10 days to pay it off. So we really did do everything with no money. And now we needed money. Big money, $250,000. So we eventually found an angel, Mike Markla, who was a technical angel, who was willing to invest the money, join us as a full working full-time marketing partner. And he knew a lot about business. He was like our mentor. What he said about here's how things go in business, and here's how you start, and here's who you have to hire, and here's how much money you need, and why, and how much you should be pursuing for the future. He knew all these things that Steve and I didn't know. So he was really the guy that made Apple successful, even though you never really hear his name. And he did say that I had to leave Hewlett Packard, and it was extremely difficult. I thought and thought and thought, you know, just laying in bed at night, what are my reasons for life? Who am I in life? And I went back and told him and Steve Jobs no at first. But then finally a friend convinced me it's okay to start a company and not feel like a businessman. You know, unethical, politics, they all added up in my mind that way. He said, you can just be an engineer at this company and be doing it to make money off what you've done, your designs, your abilities. And, you know, I realized once one person said that, I said, good, now I'm willing to say that, and that's my role at Apple, and we started.
How important was, I mean, obviously today Apple's very much defined in part by its aesthetics. How important was that back in the early days?
The aesthetics, well, first of all, I conceived of a computer looking like a typewriter. I had grown up typing very fast, you know, even beating the girls in typing too, so I was very good as a typist, and I just thought of that paradigm, so we built these wooden boxes. Steve Jobs wanted to take it even further and build a plastic case. And a plastic case, it's hard to say that it looks better than a wooden case, but it's more manufacturable. It's lower cost. And he knew a guy that had a special plastics technology in Palo Alto. And so a lot of the looks of the Apple II were just really, really good to define, you know. What should a small computer be? It's hard to say anything, you know, ever really did better. So from the start, we prided ourselves on not only having simpler computers that get you turn it on, and it's doing something very easy and understandable for you, which is running a programming language, BASIC. But it's also kind of nice looking. And everything about it is just simple as a hi-fi. Steve Jobs was more than myself. I love to talk about microprocessors and the buses and the chips and the interrupt signals and whether they have to be low or whether they have to be high. Steve wanted to hide the technology because he was less of an engineer, and he had never done software. I think his software fears might have been behind. He wanted to hide technology from people, normal people like himself, and just see what you need to actually type and get closer to humanness. And that's part of the aesthetics too, you know, just the usability of a machine.
How quickly did the company grow? What was that like to experience?
Yeah, right from the start, we had a lot of sales. Computer stores were opening across the country. You didn't have to have a real hard-driving sales staff to take shelf space away from other products. They didn't have any products. So the Apple was the standout product, so almost every store wanted some Apples in it, if it was a general computer store, unless it was associated with a company like Radio Shack sold TRS-80s. Commodore stores sold the PETs. But pretty much all the ones selling Altair-type computers all became Apple stores. That was the big product. It was really easy to move in and start selling. So our sales were going up, and everybody, we were hiring a few people, very young people, you know, just to do a little bit of manufacturing jobs and testing jobs. And we were growing, and we were very, very well managed. I mean, our president, Mike Scott, kept us very trim. And nobody left, I don't think, for the first couple of years, 2-3 years. Maybe if they did, it was salespeople in marketing or something. Every one of us felt that we were on top of a revolution and we were leading it. The newspaper articles, the press was so with us. It was with personal computers, but the personal computer of that era that had made it was the Apple II. And they were just article after article after article and news stories and everything. Everything was positive, telling the world what we had to tell them. We had to tell people, this is a computer, but it belongs in a house now. It's not the old computer which you'd never ever want near your life. This is a computer that can actually help you with friendly, normal human things. So part of our fancifulness of Apple, right from our name on, helped in that regard.
What was the culture like there? I mean, I'm presuming you probably were quite far removed from the kind of stuffed shirt, kind of regular corporate America at that time.
I think every small startup company, especially when we're starting by a couple of young 20-year-olds, basically, no, we almost never wore suits. Occasionally, there were times when we had to go to a show to present the Apple II when we introduced it. Oh yeah, Mike Markla told us, everybody will wear suits and ties and be dressed in this nice styled way. Or if we went to certain business meetings, yes, you have to wear a suit. So we wore suits when we had to, but almost never other times. Everything was pretty casual. in those early days, we didn't have projects, a management team that's coming up with management schedules and getting products definitions approved and okaying funds for this group based on what they've said they'll do. No, pretty much we just said, well, we need a printer interface. Why don't you work on that, Wendell? And Steve, God, we need this floppy. You have any ideas? And we'd just start to get them to work, and we'd be just designing whatever we came up with and making up our ideas, finding out what we could do. Almost everything we did, though, was gold. Everything he did was gold. There was a market to sell it right away. The computer was out there selling, so every time you made an addition to it, software or hardware, there were lots of people that wanted to buy and test this new stuff. So we couldn't really fail if we, we did a printer interface this week instead of a modem interface. Maybe we did the wrong thing. Nothing like that.
So kind of fast forward 10 years, you were just talking about a very exciting time, you're kind of riding on this revolution. 10 years later, things had changed, and Apple was in kind of slightly in the doldrums at some point in kind of the early 90s.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, within 3 years, we had one of the most successful stock offerings ever. Steve and I, kind of a shock at what could happen to you in your life. A few years after that, by 1983, the IBM PC had been introduced, and they had a big marketing arm into corporations, and the world was going towards business use of computers. And IBM passed us up in computers, computer sales or computers in the world. And that trend kind of continued for quite a while, even into the 90s, like you talk about. Apple had times, this was a large, large company, way up on the Fortune 500 list, close to Fortune 100. When companies, things get very large, their stock changes very gradually over time. The bigger something is, the less it moves. It's called inertia. Thing is, Apple stock would go up or down 2x in just a few months based upon hot new products or competition that looked bad or, good or bad prospects for the company, because we only had one product ever. And those were very emotionally trying incidences, especially when the stock went way, way down. And, oh my gosh, you've got half of what you thought you had. And it would happen. One of the times that it happened was, I don't remember the exact years and dates when we had our problems. I think 85 we had some severe problems and had to really organize the company. But we still had the Apple II bringing in the money, bringing in the bread, to let us survive through a lot of these other crunches we went through.
So what was it like, how do you feel Apple fared once in that period when, both you and Jobs weren't there anymore? Did it lose its original spirit?
I think Apple actually pretty much kept its original spirit. The Apple community was so alive and outspoken and passionate. They were Apple's biggest resource, and what they wanted in terms of products were there. The thing is, you can have tiny little nuances that make the difference, that adds up to the whole world for the real users. And a lot of users were just thinking that our products didn't have that little special essence that makes them a science fiction computer instead of a good computer, a great computer instead of a good computer. And we might have lost that a bit, and I think it was coming back, just needed some dressing and work on it. This is in the 90s. Yeah, we had some terrible problems in the 90s. We had a line of computers called the Performa, and what's the difference between the Performa this and the Macintosh that? And hard to tell them apart. They didn't have that you look at and say, oh, I'm drooling. I have to have that. I got to save my money and get that one, even though it's more expensive. Now, we lost that flavor somewhat for a while. But the core that we kept of users loved their Macintoshes and were ever loyal. For a while, we licensed our operating systems, let other companies build the Macintosh hardware. But we got into a lot of places where they were building the high-end machines where the good profits were. And we were bleeding because of it. And they were also some incompatibilities. Some would work with some graphics boards or monitors, and others wouldn't. And it was becoming a messier world for the Macintosh users. Macintosh users have always had a very nice life where there aren't a lot of choices. Pretty much there's a standard products for any type of hardware or software. And that means you don't have to think very much. It just goes together and works. And when things stop working, that just goes against our whole corporate philosophy from day one of make it easy. Jeff Raskin was a guy that was really instrumental in teaching Steve and I come into the garage, and he would teach us that you make one product and it can do the job, you make another product and do the job, but you spend extra time to make it so easy and obvious for even a child to use, or a housewife that knows nothing about computers at all could come in and figure out how to use it, you have done a better job for more people in the world.
Moving on to the web, and back in the early 90s when, it was almost like a hobbyist kind of setup with the Usenet. You know, it was academics and enthusiasts and so on. And then kind of Mosaic came out, and we had the kind of early part of the web where kind of normal people got hold of it.
When the web first came, I was pretty much, I was teaching classes, I was involved with schools, I was using the Macintosh and keeping up with all the hardware and software, but I sort of only heard from friends what was happening on the web. From a friend at UC Santa Clara, that he showed another friend of mine the internet, and my friend said, "Whoa, you won't believe how incredible this is." And then Steve Jobs came to my dad's funeral and said that he got Stanford to extend a T1 line to his house so he could have the internet at high speed right at his house. I went down to Apple, and one of the engineers, Martin Haberly, I think was his name, showed me Mosaic running. Whoa, this was so impressive, because Mosaic was the first web browser that had graphics, pictures in with the text. And then Netscape started up. So I used Netscape in my first computer class and got the Netscape engineers to come right down from Sunnyvale or Mountain View, wherever they were, and they'd come into my class and teach the kids how to use it. What a world that was opening up here. It was scary for me too, because I sort of switched direction and learned how to set up all the network, all the internet equipment. The equipment that switches the signals onto phone company type lines, that runs them high speed. You have to type in all these categories of strange geeky numbers to set up your network so all the computers will work. Very complicated, especially when I started running networks all over my school district. So I became a network administrator for a while. And it's a thankless job, because sometimes you're a middleman. There's the internet up above you, and then there's your part of supplying it to the people below you. And when something goes wrong, you can't necessarily fix it. Sometimes it's the guys up above you, the phone company or the internet supplier, and you spend forever just everybody's blaming you and you can't fix it.
Did you see any parallels with, you know, kind of Andreessen, those early Mosaic guys, to what you'd done 20 years earlier in terms of the idealism of this new, amazing new technology?
Yeah, I see some parallels. Mark Andreessen was pretty young, although I haven't really met him and spoken to him. He was at a university as a grad student and basically wanted to do a better version of Mosaic, you know, do Mosaic and then, Netscape was the better version. But he wanted to take HTTP that Tim Berners-Lee had come up with and somehow incorporate graphics and pictures in it. You know, and a lot of people talk about it, but, you know, it's really tough for the one person who really does it. As soon as he had it, it just took over the world. I mean, everyone had to have it in one day. That's a revolutionary product, and it didn't come out of a ton of money. You know, or support, or a company that came up with the plan, here's what we'll sell. It was unexpected. They're very, very similar.
What impact did the web have on you know, Apple and the other kind of companies from the older Silicon Valley order?
Well, the web, you know, had impacts on Apple and Microsoft. Like each company said, well, Microsoft kind of disdained some parts of the web at first, that it wasn't going to be earth-shattering, and Apple was, we're going to be the internet company, but they really didn't make any changes. Like, whoa, you buy this machine from Apple and all of a sudden you've got the internet. No, I still had to run the internet on a Sun computer for quite a while. So I don't know what the impact was. I think it was just gradual over time, you know, getting up to living with the internet. Who wrote a browser? Apple didn't write a browser. It was Netscape, you know, and eventually Microsoft or, you know, other guys around the world.
Was there like a new generation that were taking over, do you think?
I think that Apple was slower to get into the internet in walk the walk ways than it should have been. I think Apple should have said, this is our forte, we're going to, you know, the internet is where the world is going, and we're going to be the first to get there and enforce and do it right. And I was sort of disappointed that Apple even took so long. Just let third-party products started popping up, and Apple did the very minimum in the operating system to allow those third parties to reach the internet. So I was disappointed. That was in the early 90s. I thought Apple was too slow and Microsoft was slow too.
So when did they get involved? I mean, presumably they were watching, you know, the whole kind of Napster thing play out with some interest.
Oh, get involved. You're talking much later time points now if you're talking Napster.
Yeah.
After a while, the internet became a critical part of the computer. You got to ship browsers with your machine, and you can, although Apple likes to build the hardware, the platform that other people, and the operating system that other people can design these applications for, and hopefully we're big enough in the world they get written. Things like internet servers. Somebody can set up their own email department, their own web server. So, you know, a lot of that, it's hard to say how much of that Apple really directed.
Just I want to ask you about a few of the kind of the big companies that came out of, you know, Web 1.0, whatever you call it these days. eBay, how much of an impact did, you know, kind of e-commerce and eBay have on you?
I don't know. I bet when they started doing eBay, they had some great ideas, and it turned out, you know, 100 times bigger than they ever thought it could be. just the whole era of swapping. When we were in our homebrew computer club, even, we didn't really talk. The internet is going to be the place where everyone swaps stuff, where everything is bought, where all the, you know, the retail culture of the world shifts to. We didn't even have those ideas back then. Once the internet was here and you could browse a web page and see something advertised, the first time I went on the web with my wife, I loaded up a place. I did a little search. I forget if it was Yahoo or something was out there with a search engine. I searched for coffee, and I found a couple places selling coffee from Hawaii, Kona Coffee. And we just purchased them, but all it was really, it created kind of like a little note to them. Here's who I am, and here's my address, and here's my credit card. So it was a simpler form. It wasn't complete commerce electronically. It was just passing a mail to somebody to order something. And then a lot of people started talking about credit cards are going to be insecure. If anyone gets your credit card number, you're in a lot of trouble. Well, that's ridiculous. We use credit cards for everything. Phone calls, credit cards. We use credit cards in stores. Anybody there could get your credit card number, and it's really protected a lot of ways. So a lot of the world didn't want to go to electronic commerce. They said it wasn't going to happen on the web. But, God, it just made so much sense to me. All of a sudden, it was so easy. Product after product after product, I could order without having to get in my car and drive down to stores, see if they have it in stock. Could do my research, too. So electronic commerce, you know, like most things that are electronic, technical, gadget-oriented, I'm one of those ones that's out in the forefront. Those of us in the forefront, sometimes we're a year ahead, sometimes two, sometimes even 10 years ahead of the direction the world goes. But we generally have a sense for what is the right way, you know, just a sense of, is this easy and direct and well enough done? This is the way people are going to want to do it in masses someday, once they get over their hindrances and their disdainment of, you know, oh, things like using credit cards.
Do you think the web is now that it's becoming much more of a kind of user-generated thing and less of a technology for most people, that it's starting to fulfill its potential?
Well, from the start, the web had this idea that all these little people are publishing because they can, and a lot of academics were able to publish scientific information and information from their research projects. And like it was like a huger library, modern, up-to-date information, a little sparse. And then it started going the way of, you know, having standard funnels that we like to go through to get our news, to get our encyclopedia, to get various types of shopping information. You know, I go to this place to buy my DVDs, for example. And I think that's human nature, that in the end, we open up the world to 1,000 different things and randomness, and after a while, we want to get our own order in ourselves as users. So we want to get it down to a few reliable, trusted sources. This whole idea of user-generated internet right now, things like, you know, YouTube, people, everybody's able to publish all of a sudden. There's another burst of that going on. And and it's great. We'd love to play with it for a while, but after a while, we still always seem to want to settle down, and we just hope we wind up with a few good guys.
When did you first hear of Google? And second part of that question is, how do you think it became a verb?
Well, I always knew that there was a Google that was a mathematical number spelled slightly differently. I just loved it. I thought it was just a great search engine. We always like to use the best search engine, so I guess I was with the masses. And we used AltaVista for a while. And they kind of snubbed their noses at Google, actually, and thought Google wouldn't be able to scale. And Google was able to scale, and they just had better search results that they returned. So I used Google, and like everyone else, I felt, you know, your home page ought to be Google. If you're going to have any home page, that's the one. And, you know, what they've become today, I'm just really glad. You know, they're out there. They've done so well. And like any, they're still in that early startup phase where all you want to do is altruistic, good things for the world, you know, and you'll actually, if you do good enough things, you'll make money off of it, you know. That's where they're still coming from. And they're so open thinking. I mean, I just read about their taking their parking lot and putting the covers over it with solar panels on to generate electricity and get shielded at the same time. I love it when you use a part for two purposes at once. That's what I used to love to do with my chips. So, you know, and I go to the campus and gosh, they've got, man, they have all these restaurants all around. I mean, eating there is great and it's easy and it's free. And it's like, you know, they treat the company like it's a family, like it's a community. And, oh, I believe so strongly in that.
Do they?
You know, just as long as it doesn't get too cultish.
Yeah, do you think they're kind of, you know, carrying on that, I don't know, that kind of a Silicon Valley tradition that you guys started off?
Well, you know, they started out pretty young, too. You know, a couple guys from Stanford. And they didn't start saying, we're going to become the superpower of the world, I think. They started saying, here's something we can do really well. Let's do ours and see where it goes. And I think they started as technicians, and that kind of early idealism and pureness, you know, sticks with you for a while. You know, I hope they don't lose control of it. As long as they're doing so well and their stock's way up, yeah, they won't lose control of that.
So what did you and Steve Jobs say to yourselves when you started? Were you going to take over the world, or was it just see what happens here?
Actually, Mike Markla gave us this advice that we could be a $500 million company in 5 years, and I sort of poo-pooed it, like, you know, just because he's had business success in his life, they all talk to the bigger numbers, but I thought it was just baloney. But he had actually studied real business, and it was quite possible and feasible and realistic, as it turned out. We didn't make it that big and quickly because of the computer that he was investing in, the first Apple II. It was the Apple II led to things we didn't really imagine or assume. Floppy disk, but really more than anything else, the first spreadsheet program, VisiCalc, that let small businessmen have a tool that could save them, you know, years and years of work in just a couple of hours they could do. So we didn't see these things, but a computer is so versatile that other people come up with the great ideas, and his thinking was pretty good. I forget what the question was, but
I guess, you know, what you and Steve were thinking when you started about how far this could go. Obviously, I'm sure you never imagined, you know, how far it would become.
Yeah, oddly enough, even in the Homebrew Computer Club, myself at first, Steve Jobs and myself, everyone in the club was talking about computers in every home, and we really believed that. We could see ways that computers kind of belonged in every home. I mean, a typewriter was in a tenth of the homes already. We could replace that. So that didn't surprise us, but how big it really is once it gets to that point. Also, how competitive it is, how it draws other people in. So many approaches, so many more. Then you've got to start working on newer computers and newer products and just use each one as a stepping stone to get to the next. And it becomes a bit of a race. But and it's hard to hold on to your original values. You know, what are you all about as a company? You know, we actually sat down and wrote that up in a business plan with Mike Markla before he put the money in. You know, basically we just want to bring good technology to the world and make a profit.
So your core values then, could you list what they...
Oh, I couldn't go back. I'm not even a businessman. So I'm the last person that pays close attention to what the core values are. I know what a product has to do, and I'm going to make it do the right thing the right way.
So in terms of your and Steve's individual skills, could you kind of list them to me? What, you know, lots of, you know, there was a homebrew club and lots of people trying to do this. What made you two such a special team?
Steve was a very, very socially able person, and I was a very shy person. And I could sit down all alone in my room and work on my designs and try to make them so perfect that no other human would come that close to making it what I called perfect. And that was my talent. I wanted to make the great computer. Steve always wanted to find ways to build things that really you could sell to a lot of other people. Not sell for the money necessarily, but sell because that's the only way you really change things on a massive level. And if you sell something on a massive level, you get some money, profit, that you can invest to design something better to sell them on a massive level. And he really did want the notoriety for, you know, basically being one of these thinkers about the human state, what human beings really want and use. When we started the company, it was easy to say. I would keep doing engineering, hardware and software. Mike Markla, who came from a marketing background, would do the marketing. Mike Scott, our president, would be in charge of operations and everything else at Key Control, and Steve would float and help every department possible and get on the phone and make calls. He would do PR, he would do getting purchasing components, he would do sales to stores, anything needed to be doing, and he would learn how to be an executive at all phases of the company. That's the way Mike Markula stated our roles, and it's exactly how it turned out.